Hello and welcome back to Hacker Slacker. I'm Jacob Petticord.
And I'm Andre Garive.
And it is midterms week.
It is.
Andre, does the tech news stop for midterms?
It does not. In fact, it picks up for midterms.
So do we stop for midterms?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not. Plus, I mean, I don't know what I would do if I was just focused on midterms and not wasting time looking at tech news. So yeah. Here we are. We have a lot of follow-ups, so let's dive in. The Apple event that we said was rumored for March, it's finally announced. Apple sent out invites to the press. They're having an event on their new campus, March 25th, and their only message along with the event was, it's showtime. And there was a GIF in the email that was kind of like the old school film, like 3-2-1 countdown,
yep,
and then the Apple logo showed up.
Should be interesting. That is the Monday after we get back from spring break, so it'll happen right before we record.
Yeah.
It'll be probably the main topic of our next episode. We won't have an episode next week because we'll be in various states that aren't Nebraska.
Yeah. But yeah, so Andre, what is It's Showtime make you think they're going to announce?
Streaming service. We've talked about this before. I've been excited. You've been excited.
Yeah.
It's showtime.
It was rumored to be a services-focused event. I'm assuming, like, with all this theming, we're just going to see the video streaming service and not, like, the whole news portion.
Yeah.
People have been talking about, which, I mean, I think the video streaming service, that's a much bigger market, much more important thing for them to
Absolutely.
Do anyways.
And the streaming service is a lot more rumor rather than the news service, which is pretty much confirmed.
Just because of all the leaks,
around.
Yeah. So, yeah. I will definitely be tuning in, and we're going to let you guys know in our next episode, but not really much more to say other than, you know, we've done our speculation on it, and I want to be surprised, but something tells me it'll be pretty standard.
Yep.
Yep. Okay, so next is actually news about a recent guest on the show, Matthew Casanelli. He tweeted out one of his articles that was kind of like a list of 100 shortcuts, kind of putting together a lot of his work and one big list, and it got retweeted by Tim Apple this week.
Yes, Tim Apple. Tim Cook,
yeah,
the CEO of Apple, retweeted one of our guests, which is super cool. Matthew was a super awesome guy to talk to. Hopefully we can have him on again in the future.
Yeah, so Tim quote retweeted it and said, worth a look, something for everyone. So yeah, it was kind of cool. I was listening to Matthew's podcast, Supercomputer, and I heard it come up, and I was like, holy crap, that was right after we had him on the show. Like,
yeah.
Dang. But yeah. You know, maybe a couple years, we'll be getting those retweets from
Tim. let's aim for that. Maybe we can get...
I mean, we already know he's a listener of the show. It's just, you know, we have to make him proud enough to, you know, tweet about us.
Absolutely. Maybe we can get, Bill Microsoft or somebody else to retweet us.
Okay. Next, The Verge met with Amazon and Eero execs about the acquisition. So, I read through their interview, and there was just kind of some interesting things. They were addressing a lot of the concerns that we and a lot of other people have been talking about. The acquisition's officially finalized. They said that the Eero executive said that they will not be changing a word of their privacy policy, kind of in reference to people thinking Amazon was going to be collecting more data. Obviously, there's nothing legally binding about him saying that, and,
yeah,
you know, what else is he going to say? But the Amazon exec said that they were excited about Eero. He said, like, I owned Eeros before we knew we were going to acquire them. And it was a great way for them to, connect all their devices in their house. Eero is actually part of a program that made it easier to, like, automatically connect all of your Amazon devices even before they got acquired. So they were already kind of, you know, partnering with Amazon in certain ways. And Amazon was like, oh, you know, it's nice having these guys, you know, be our central system for our hub of devices. Let's just, you know, make it official and buy them. So they said they're planning on keeping them, like, as independent as possible. And basically they were just trying to say, like, hey, we're not going to do all that scary stuff you talked about, but I mean, come on.
Yeah, we'll see. Obviously to have this integrated technology, it's going to have some crossover. There's going to be a lot of engineering work, but I think it'll be worth it, because we're going to get a mesh Wi-Fi system that can completely connect your devices on a network level.
Yeah, so I mean, you buy your Echo device and it'll probably just be able to, you know, like, if you buy it and knows the account you have, if that account's also linked to your Eero router, you could literally just plug it in and it could be ready to go on your network. So,
and I can only imagine it'll make it easier for, like, Echo to Echo calls across a house or playing music at the same time simultaneously in different rooms.
Oh yeah,
all that kind of stuff.
And I mean, a couple of there's been a few times in the last couple of years where people have said, like, wow, because of this, it's really weird, you know, thinking about how Apple discontinued their Wi-Fi routers. And this is another thing where it's like, Amazon saw the value of having Wi-Fi routers connect all this smart home stuff. Apple's trying to, you know, up their smart home game a little bit with, like, integrating with TVs like we've talked about in the past and, you know, the HomePod and everything. But now they're out of the router business, so.
Yeah.
Amazon's in it.
Yep. And the Eero three-part bundle was discounted. Super cool.
$100 off, you know, yeah. Just...
consumer benefit, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly, you know, we'll talk about this later, but with the scale of these companies, they're able to offer some pretty competitive prices with the scale that Amazon has, so.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so the next thing we have is one of the things we talked about on the show was the ads that, or kind of the data that a lot of these new smart TVs are selling to like advertisers about the information that you're watching. It's like the content ID systems. Well, another like step, like kind of what we're seeing as the next step in the future of like in TV advertisements is that Vizio is forming a partnership with a lot of other TV manufacturers that are saying they're going to implement the system. TV networks like NBC and CBS and then other ad tech companies, they're forming a partnership to deliver targeted ads on a household basis to your screen. So the way that they laid this out was kind of a replacement for your traditional like cable ads. There would be ads kind of served over the internet in between your shows that were more like highly targeted, like YouTube's able to serve, and less just like targeted for your general like location, like yeah. Your local ads can run.
So if you are let's say you're 22 years old, but for some reason you really like watching antiquing shows, you're not going to get catheter commercials every time anymore. This will actually serve you the kind of ads that you may want the products from. It's, in my opinion, it's a really good idea. The reason we've heard about the death of the television so much, and especially the death of network television, is because it's just less useful to advertise on those platforms when you can get highly specific and highly targeted ads on a platform that people have on mobile, on their TVs, and on their computers.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this could improve the TV advertising for both the consumers and the sellers. And then, along with that, I am like, depending on the way Vizio like inserts themselves and the other TV manufacturers in this technology, it could again, like be another way that they're monetizing after the sale of the TV and drive the initial Absolutely. Prices of these TV down even more. So,
yeah, because, the TV is going to be what controls, the access to the internet, the content, how those, are served up. Obviously they have to work it out with networks and advertisers. But you got to get the TV manufacturer in there somehow if you want to serve these highly specialized ads to people on a TV on network television.
Yeah, so it's they kind of just like formed a group that's like agreeing upon the standard. No real like movement towards implementing it yet, but Vizio says they're going to do it. So we'll definitely be on watch for when it actually starts to come out. But yeah, now to move into the news. 9to5 Mac, we have another Ming-Chi Kuo report. He is saying that the first Apple AR headset product will go into production by the end of 2019 or the first quarter of 2020.
Yeah, super exciting. I love Ming-Chi Kuo rumors. That's like my favorite thing to see on Twitter or on my Chrome preview is that, oh, there's a new Apple rumor.
Yeah, I was really not expecting to see this, like even this year, you know. The fact that he is... you know, the go-to guy on the production side of things. So the fact that he's saying that these AR headsets are going into production means that, yes, Apple has been working on these for years now.
Absolutely.
And they are, like, have a finalized design that they're ready to move into production this year.
Yeah.
Like, when you think about the manufacturing lifestyle of it, if they're going into production by the end of the year, that means, like, they're having to set up these deals about who's going to produce it. That means they already have an idea of the components, you know. They definitely have to have been working on the software. The design's mostly finalized at this point. So there are people in Apple that know what this headset looks like.
Yeah, I can only imagine they've been working on it for probably about 4 years at this point, if not more.
Back in 2017, Bloomberg had a report that AR glasses were going to come out. And back then they predicted that like their Apple's aggressive deadline was 2020. And so it looks like they're going to be hitting that deadline in terms of like starting manufacturing.
Yeah.
But it just shows you like... this is something that's been coming down the pipeline. Apple's clearly betting on it being the next big thing. I agree with them, but there has not been any big consumer movement. So I haven't really seen reports that, you know, other smartphone manufacturers are going as heavily into this. I'm sure Google's working on some consumer product. You know, I'm sure they're working on a little bit of everything, but if Apple turns out to be the big first consumer bet, I think that would be pretty surprising to me.
Yeah.
Because they're rarely first to market in these categories.
That's exactly what I was going to say, because usually when you see these new technologies, they come in and Apple is the one who makes it the most consumer friendly and the best and most beautiful, the best designed, the best hardware. They make it the best. They don't make it first.
Yeah. I mean, like, we've seen like the North glasses and the Google glasses a long time ago, but you'd think that, you know, it would kind of reach the area that smartphones did before the iPhone, where we had like the Razors and like really mass market products before Apple steps in and gives us like the, you know, the user-friendly solution, like you said. But it just makes me think, like, are we going to start seeing, like, the Huawei, the Samsung smart glasses in the next, like, before the year's over, like, going for sale? But you would think, you know, they just had all these big Mobile World Congress things. You would have thought there would have been some, like, rumors around
Especially the smaller companies. Like, I can imagine Samsung might be working on something, but we're not going to hear about it for a little while. But maybe Huawei or Xiaomi or something. But alas, we haven't, which is just super interesting because, like when we talked about the North Focals, you mentioned that they're kind of like a Google Glass 1.5.
Yeah.
If Apple makes it, it's going to be 2.0. It's going to be that leap, because they're not going to put out something that isn't going to, like, amaze. The last time that they put out something that wasn't up to par, I guess, technologically, at least, I can't even remember. Maybe the most recent update of the iPod Nano? Like, it's been a while.
They, so Ming-Chi Kuo says that this device will be heavily dependent on the phone, a lot like the watches. Like, I mean, I'm assuming it's going to be wirelessly paired, but, like, the report said that he didn't specify. But he said the phone will do a lot of the actual, like, computational rendering as far as, like, AR stuff goes, and then just kind of send the video to the glasses, which I think could be an advantage over, like, being able to do more complex stuff and have a longer battery life on the glasses themselves.
Better to have the processing take place on the phone because it will obviously take bulk off of the glasses. It will make them look nicer.
Yeah, for sure. Right now, where technology is today, you would want a lot of that to be able to be done on the phone. And then hopefully eventually, you know, if we move to just smart glasses in the future, we can do that. But it's kind of like a good first step to be like, hey, these glasses are kind of like a second display for your phone.
Yeah. I'd be interested if they somehow make it so you can, like, unlock your phone by just, like, looking at it. Obviously there's Face ID, right? But sometimes that's not as fast. But if you have the glasses on and it knows that it's you, you can just, like, look at your phone and it'll unlock. I don't know. There's a functionality on the Apple Watch where if you can set it and it'll automatically unlock your MacBook. I loved having that feature. If I had my watch on, I would just open it up and it would unlock. So maybe something like that. Just cool little features that I can imagine Apple putting in. And I'm actually really excited to see what happens with this.
Well, and one of the crazy things about this is Apple has not released a product, like, without an app store on it and without letting developers know ahead of time in a long time.
Yeah.
You know, the first iPhone, the app store didn't come out for a couple years afterwards. That was 2006. You know, they realized that they live and die by the app stores. And so unless this is going to be, like, a very single use, like, Apple has well-defined use cases for this and is not, you know, like, intending this to be a platform. But I think that, you know, if this is going to be their next big bet, it's going to have to be a platform.
Yeah. So, and it may be a thing where the technology is so revolutionary and they are getting to it first that they make it work natively with their software. Because if you're buying Apple AR glasses, you more than likely have more than just an iPhone. You probably have a MacBook or an iPad or an Apple Watch or AirPods or something, right? You're in the ecosystem, most likely, if you're buying these.
Yeah.
So if you're in the ecosystem, you're also more than likely to be using their built-in apps.
Well, but where I was going with this was if they're betting on this being their next big platform, it's going to need a store. And if they're going to have developers develop for it, we are going to hear a lot of specifics about how this is generally going to work from the development standpoint at WWDC in July. If they're manufacturing these devices, I'm assuming, like, they are going to have some sort of a platform on them. And in which case, like, there are going to be a lot of details out here in the next 4 months from Apple about how this is all going to go down.
Yeah. And it's a platform that hasn't really been explored yet, especially when it comes to app development.
The only thing that I've seen in terms of, like, an AR app store is the Magic Leap has a whole development kit for their thing that they tried to push, but it never really went far. But, I mean, in terms of getting third parties on board, if they are, like, having app support for this thing, then Apple has definitely already reached out to, like, their major partners about, you know, how this is going to work. Like, we need to get you guys on board with this. Because that sort of stuff has to happen, you know, like, a full year in advance. You can't just expect Google Maps to come to your platform, like, because you announced it a week ago, you know.
Yeah. And what's interesting about the WWDC from last year and the iPhone event is the stress they put on AR.
Oh, yeah.
And developers obviously now have the capability to develop in AR with Swift, and then you can also process AR super well on the newer iPhones, but there wasn't really that much of a reason to.
But they still pushed it super hard. But they did
push it very hard.
It was kind of like, hey guys, this is going to be really important. I mean, we're showing you this guy holding this iPad and looking at fake Legos, but like, hey guys, this is really important.
Yeah, and I think come June, we will retrospectively look back and see, oh wow, they were giving us a huge hint.
Yeah, I would be very surprised if, like, they don't say anything about it at WWDC, and then, like, early next year, we just hear they're launching, like, they announce their glasses, and then it comes out with just support for their things, because, I mean, I don't even know if Apple could make a navigation app for the glasses at this point. Like, I don't know if I trust their, like, AR map development to be that intense, you know?
Yeah.
We'll see.
I don't know. Which comes first, AirPower or AR headset?
AirPower, only because I think it's coming at the next, I don't know, I think it's gotta come soon.
We said that at the last three events, right?
I think that they have to put out the new AirPods soon, because
that's true.
If they're gonna get them on, like, some sort of a release cycle, they gotta get it going.
Yeah.
Because people love AirPods, and people would gladly buy new ones if they were wirelessly charging. And I think that when they announce that, they'll also announce AirPower.
It would be interesting if the reason we didn't get AirPower at our last one is so that they could sell it at the same time as new AirPods, which would just be hilarious because AirPower was delayed by itself and then AirPods forcing it to be further delayed.
Who knows? We'll see. Either way, it should be an exciting next year for Apple with whatever they do after this iPhone X design coming out this year.
And the new iPhone design is going to be super interesting to see.
Yeah, and if they somehow tie that in with these new glasses. So I'm excited.
So am I.
Yeah, hopefully we're at the start of a, like, new sea change for the handheld technology industry. So, yeah. Google made a new feature on their app store that allows Android apps to monetize in a new way. So, typically, apps on the Android and iOS app stores can monetize through Google or Apple in two ways, you know, subscriptions and app purchases. Those are the two things they offer. And then if you want to serve ads, you can go through, like, third-party ad networks, you know, download some libraries.
Just serve up ads on your own app within itself.
And a lot of that stuff is where you'll see some of this, like, problematic privacy stuff where people will download app library or advertisement libraries to serve advertisements, and then that code will just collect as much data as possible, maybe more than the developer originally intended, so... I think this is almost in a response to that. Google is announcing reward products, which are ways that, you know, people can enjoy, like, freemium games and still support developers. So, like, you could... This first one is, like, reward video, and it's that thing that a lot of apps are doing already where, like, maybe between levels or in order to get some sort of in-app currency, like a full-screen video ad pops up. And you watch that video. When you complete it, you can go on to the next level or you get your coins or whatever it is. This is something that was kind of already being done for years now, but it's interesting that Google is, like, finally putting out a, like, standard way to do this.
Yeah. I mean, they might as well get in on it, right?
Yeah. I mean, Google sells ads, so they might as well.
They'll be plenty good at it. You have to log in to download the app. They're going to be able to serve you the ads.
Yep. And this is also a good, the Android developers need more ways to monetize because they have not been having the success with subscriptions that iOS has had, where like you see subscriptions and like literally everything. The Android users are just more used to watching ads and less used to like actually paying for things. So
for sure,
it's a different type of, you know, it's a different ecosystem over there, and so this probably fits more into that than it does into the iOS ecosystem. You know, like if I was on Instagram and all of a sudden like full screen ads were taking over, I'd be like, okay, this is annoying. But
yeah,
it'll be, we'll see how it goes.
Absolutely.
Those sirens?
Those are sirens. Sorry about those sirens.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Anyways, so Nintendo is launching an $80 Labo VR kit. I don't know if we talked about Labo when it initially launched, but they're essentially like cardboard things that you build. So they come in these pieces, you assemble them. The assembly, I hear, is like half the fun. And then you insert your Nintendo Switch, their new console, I guess it's not really new anymore.
Yeah.
Their console into them. And then if it's like a, you know, if you assembled like a fishing rod, it'll play like a fishing game where like you moving the fishing pole actually like affects the game. Well, they kind of Google cardboarded it, which, I mean, they were already using cardboard. They were halfway there, but they launched their VR kit, which is essentially trying to turn the Switch into like a pseudo VR headset. And there's, this is interesting for like a few reasons. One, like Nintendo was one of the first people to get into VR a really long time ago with like the Virtual Boy, and it went terribly.
Yes, the Virtual Boy.
And it made everybody sick, and it's kind of just a meme. And it was the reason why VR was dormant for so many years. And now this is the first thing they've done since then, and it's essentially Google Cardboard, except the screen is like bigger than phone screens, and the screen quality is lower quality, and it'll be, I'm assuming, another nauseating Nintendo VR experience.
Yeah, I don't know if Nintendo needs to be particularly getting into groundbreaking technology. The Switch was a good groundbreaker for them.
Yeah, I was actually, Andre saw it before I got in here, or he got in here, but I have, like, for my trip to San Francisco, I'm taking trains, 40-hour trains, and so I was looking for things to do on that, and I was like, oh, I should borrow someone's Switch and play the new, like, the Zelda game that, you know, was came out a while ago and looked super cool. So I'm actually borrowing someone's for that, so I'll actually get to use a Switch for the first time this next week. Good little spring break video gaming. But but from what I've seen of it and from what I've heard of it, it is definitely not like a crazy high fidelity, you know, high refresh rate, really good gyroscope kind of device that you need for VR. So I wonder if we'll see reports of like kids getting sick after after using this VR kit.
A lot of young kids on this. This could be not so great.
Yeah, and if they're trying to pitch it as like the good intro to VR for like kids or something like that, I think a lot more people have PlayStation 4s than have Nintendo Lavos, or I mean have Switches.
Yeah.
And so like I think the best intro to VR is PSVR, because like
absolutely
that thing's like $200.
A little more built out.
A little more built out. A really good library of games.
Yes.
And a very comparable experience to like the first generation of VR devices for a significantly cheaper price when you throw in the price of like a gaming PC, the $600 headsets that is what they usually cost. So
yeah,
I would definitely recommend that if you were actually looking for a starting place in VR. But yeah. This next one is like a news item that turned into me learning about a company that was kind of interesting. So I saw this news item that streaming service Quibi is announcing a show about Evan Spiegel and the founding slash funding of Snapchat. And this show is kind of purported to be like the social network, except for Snapchat, which extremely enticing to me. Sounds like an interesting movie. And I was like, wait a second, like, what the heck is Quibi? What are they doing?
I've also never heard of Quibi. Yeah.
So, the more I dug into them, you know, I went to their website, they had, like, a really mysterious, like, you know, where Silicon Valley meets Hollywood, you know, creating, like, you know, very buzzwordy website about how they're going to be producing, like, very, like, consumable content.
Yeah.
You know, shorter content coming out a lot, and, like, they're going to leverage, you know, their Silicon Valley smarts and whatever. But yeah, it says quick bites of captivating entertainment created for mobile by the best talent, designed to perfectly fit into any moment of your day. But yeah, so there is some real and significant like money and talent behind this thing. The two people who are kind of running the show are Jeff Katzenberg, who was the chairman of Walt Disney Studios during the 90s, during like their animated film comeback with The Lion King and The Little Mermaid.
It's a pretty good snag.
Yeah, very good snag. I mean, it's kind of their company, but yeah. So, and then he's partnering with Meg Whitman, who's supposed to be like the Silicon Valley side of things, who's the former CEO of HP. So yeah, very intense industry clout going on here. Yeah. Not hard to imagine them raising a lot of money, which they did. Reportedly, they've raised over $1 billion. And what does that help them get? Oh, a lot of content. Again, yes. You're going to make a streaming service no one's ever really heard of. You don't have any name brand recognition. Where are you going to get that? Oh, it's all the content you're going to acquire. So they've hired a bunch of executives from like network television to like be on staff, like CBS execs. And then I'm assuming with those people, they have started to hire people for shows. You know, they've got producers like Jennifer Lopez coming on, like just signing some celebrities. They're doing a show with Justin Timberlake. They're doing a show produced by Kobe Bryant.
Yeah.
A bunch of stuff like this. And the reason we're hearing about them is because they were at South by Southwest, which like, I would probably not the right person to describe this. Maybe you can handle it better. But my understanding is that it's just kind of like a big new media / new tech show and new movie show in Austin, Texas.
It's an everything new show in Austin, Texas. The entire city of Austin just kind of explodes for a week. And it's insane. I was in Austin at the same time as South by Southwest last year. Did not get to attend South by Southwest, unfortunately, mm-hmm. but I did see all of the hubbub of the city. 9th Street, the big street in Austin, was basically completely shut off to traffic. There were people everywhere. The event center was popping, music playing everywhere. It was an insane experience. Maybe in future years we can get a Hacker Slacker on the ground recording at South by Southwest. But
that sounds like a fun trip.
Yeah, so something like this is very interesting because it's the proliferation of who you know rather than what you know. And I'm sure they know how to make a streaming service and all that, but they're teaming up with all of these execs, right? They're getting connections, which is a very unique business model for a streaming service that might actually work.
Yeah, I mean, they're acquiring content.
Because
it just takes a couple of these shows to blow up.
If they just buy the content, they don't have to know how to make great content yet.
Yeah, so my interpretation of the shows they're making is that like they're not going to try to make like a Game of Thrones style long form content thing. They're more trying to make something that like you would find on a really high quality YouTube channel.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that's exactly the type of like stuff that I'm into most days is like, oh, if I'm going to sit down and watch something, a lot of times it's like pulling out my phone, watching like a high quality like MKBHD video.
That's exactly what I was going to say. You told me about his S10 review and how high quality his videos have gotten, and I then watched it, and you do really notice now he has kind of taken it from because he used to be like, he started as a tiny tech reviewer just reviewing like cables,
what he had,
what he had, and then he built it up to where he was the like a well-renowned tech reviewer, and now he's like a producer. He truly produces great content that just happens to be reviewing tech.
And even since he's been like top dog, I've seen his video content like improve leaps and bounds. Like the stuff he's doing now, it's really worth watching, even just for like the pure like film aesthetic quality of the stuff he produces.
If anybody wants to watch a tech video but isn't super into tech, I always tell them MKBHD.
Oh yeah.
He's
number one for a reason.
Absolutely, for sure.
But yeah, so if they can pump out this like super polished but also like short form, like very, you know, high engagement to low duration content, like that is something I could see totally like disrupting the model of and the content that services like Netflix and Hulu provide, you know. Maybe they'll move away from like, oh hey, you know, maybe every show we produce doesn't have to be 30 minutes and doesn't have to be, you know, shot on a set and like this sort of thing. Like maybe like a tech reviewer can have a show on one of these subscription services.
If you have 12-minute episodes of tech reviewers and...
Or just like an interview show. Just like, there are plenty of like if the Hot Ones was on a channel like this.
Yes.
Like that's stuff that I love, and that's stuff that would perfectly fit into like a more studio backed, like subscription based environment than it kind of does on YouTube right now. So yeah,
for sure.
I definitely think there's a market for this, and I also think that they could end up producing crap and never getting anywhere. So
that is we'll also see how it goes. True. Yes.
Yeah. So next is a story that when me and Andre were looking at it, we kind of like we smelled a little stink on it. It was we saw a bunch of like your typical news outlets reporting about this major leak from Box, you know, and it's like, okay, let's see what happened, because you know, like the university uses Box. Box is a very like enterprise security focused company.
Yes.
It would be really surprising if they had this massive data leak that affected all of their biggest customers, like all these news stories were claiming. So, you know, we dug in, we got to the bottom of it, found the TechCrunch article that referenced the, you know, security research article, got to the very bottom, and what happened? Well, essentially, there were reports coming out that like companies were getting public or were exposing things publicly that they didn't mean to be public. But the reason those things were public is because the companies were creating publicly shareable links to documents. So like if you're in Google Drive or something and you want to share like a Google Doc, one of the things you can do is create a shareable link, send it to someone, they click on the link, they can view it.
Exactly.
Exact same thing exists in Box. And so people at these companies, like including Apple and including like a bunch of like Fortune 500 companies, were, you know, using their Box accounts, sharing stuff with coworkers, using these public links, which is not really the way you're supposed to do it. You know,
no.
You keep them private and you invite people, because what was happening was basically this like security research group was able to kind of like brute force a company's like possible space of shareable URLs and just kind of keep guessing until they found stuff.
Yeah.
And they were able to find a lot of things, including like, you know, like, I think that there was like a bank where someone found like a couple million emails in an Excel sheet. It's just like a bunch
of sensitive health records were found.
Yeah. Just like a bunch of stuff that should not be public.
Yeah.
And so I really think this is less of a security problem and more of like a user interface problem, where Absolutely. Maybe Box needs to design their interface in a way that is like warning you, if you create this link, you really are exposing, like, public means public, watch out, you know,
it's like,
don't put your 2 million email spreadsheet on a shareable link.
It's not public to you and the person you're sharing with.
Yeah.
It's public to anybody who can find the URL.
Uh-huh.
So,
which on the internet, with all the like power a lot of people have, is a lot of people.
I think if you see if you saw a headline that happened to say like massive Box leak reveals thousands of records and personal information, it's wrong. It's massive failure on the part of corporate users causes their own data to be shared publicly to the internet.
And so like Box like kind of acknowledge that there's things that they can do to improve the situation, you know, like I think they like just made a button for these companies to delete all these links, kind of clear out and start fresh, and then I'm sure they'll be doing things to like obscure these links to make them harder to find. But I mean, the real solution is just maybe an interface that makes it easier to share with someone in a different way other than like exposing it to the public, right? This next story is about the Amazon Alexa ecosystem. Bloomberg had a report this week about how we are 4 years and 80,000 skills into the Amazon Alexa ecosystom. And my Alexa is listening.
All right, we got it turned off.
Okay, so we are pretty deep into this. You know, if this was the app store, we would have seen, you know, Instagram by now. We would have seen, like, the killer apps. Spotify already would have launched all this stuff. But instead, what the landscape looks like now and what people use these devices for, which I found extremely accurate in my life, is that it's really nice to ask it to play music.
Mm-hmm.
It's really nice to ask it to set timers and alarms.
Yep.
I do that every day. And some people use it to get daily news.
I do that as well.
People do that as well. So right now, that's what these things are used for. And outside of that, there's not much innovation going on in terms of like other use cases for these devices. And at the beginning, when they were first launching the Alexa like skills platform, I was thinking like, yeah, like that's what it is now. But you know, people are going to find different use cases for it because that's what developers do. You know, they make the killer app.
Yeah.
And we thought the same thing when the Apple Watch came out. And it turns out, like, you know, maybe some of these devices just have pretty simplistic use cases right now.
Absolutely.
Because of just, like, the real limits of the technology at the moment.
And I think one of the biggest limits on the skills market is the fact that the Fire Phone failed so hard. If we still had a Fire Phone and you still could work in the Fire, or what I would assume they would call the Alexa ecosystem, I think we could have some really awesome applications. The skills are the easiest things to make. Obviously, there's Android, and then there's Google Assistant, and then there's Siri and iOS. But seeing as Alexa is the most developer-friendly and probably the smartest, the most massive at this point, the Fire Phone's failure hits even harder, especially to Amazon.
Yeah, and I think even with a tighter integration to the phone, like, I think we would still see, like, these basic use cases, you know, like, 4 years, I think that there's a lot that could have been done in that time if there was, like, solutions that the technology could provide right now for this sorts of thing. And where I think a lot of the limiting factors in is just, like, the current state of artificial intelligence and machine learning. You know, like, these inputs that we were able to, like, give to it, it's really, like, it's kind of like we're in the command line days and no one's really invented the graphical user interface for voice right now, you know? You have your keywords and then a phrase that it matches to an app, and maybe you get, like, one parameter to give that app, but there's really, you know, like, just natural user interface for it where you're just having a conversation.
Yeah, you don't have Jarvis from Iron Man.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, the real utility of these things beyond these, like, simple use cases that I mentioned will definitely hit when we have smarter artificial intelligence, and I just don't know how far away we are from getting a more Jarvis-like experience. Like, you know, like, what is, how long does it take to close that gap, you know?
Yeah.
It could be another 20 years, or it could be another 5, or another 3.
With the rate that AI is growing, it'll be interesting to see, because also, if we get something that's very Jarvis-like, it's going to come with a lot of regulation. It's going to freak people out.
Yeah. I just think we're so close yet so far from, like, a lot of this stuff, like, reaching its peak, and I think that, like, this report about how, you know, how far into this we are and how little, like, big successes there's been kind of, like, proves out that the technology just isn't there for, like, something that you would use every day yet outside of, like, these kind of basic things that people already use.
Yeah.
And one of the kind of interesting things that I saw in the details was that there's still app developers, a decent amount of app developers that make a living producing apps for the Echo. Because Amazon has something called the Amazon Developer Rewards Program, where essentially, like, they will be your customer. They'll pay you to put apps on their platform.
Yeah.
Some developers are making up to $5,000 per skill per month. So, like, making a living just producing apps for the Amazon App Store that Amazon deems as good. And, you know, even if you never see a dime from a customer, then that's kind of how they're filling up their App Store.
Yeah.
Which is kind of similar how to Microsoft filled up the Windows Phone App Store. They would pay developers to, like, port their apps over, but they never really had the demand.
Yeah.
And it never really proved out for Microsoft, and it's not really proving out for Amazon, so.
No.
Yep. That is all we have for the news. After the break, we're going to be talking about Elizabeth Warren and her plan to break up the big tech. All right, and we're back with our deep dive about Elizabeth Warren's plan to break up big tech. This generated a lot of news this week.
Yes, it did.
I think that it was a combination of, like, there's just generally been a negative sentiment towards the big tech companies over the last, you know, like, year even, like, just with all this, like, you know, Facebook privacy issues, Amazon HQ hunts, which, speaking of the place that she held this rally where she announced all this, Long Island, New York, right where Amazon's HQ2 was supposed to be, but pulled out. So, yeah, she had some hometown support, I would say, with these plans.
Yeah, for sure.
But, yeah, so basically, the gist of her arguments is that there's two things she views as problems with the state of kind of, like, monopolistic big tech companies. She says that you can either be an umpire in a game or player. You cannot be both. And in the context of these tech companies, it means you can be a platform or you can be a seller / you know, user of that platform. You can't be both. And if you want to look for examples of this, it's Amazon selling items on the Amazon store. It's Google and its products that it owns that it shows in search results. And even Facebook, advertising on Facebook, Apple having its own apps in the App Store, everything. So this hits, like, all the major tech companies. And kind of the argument behind it is that if Amazon is providing a platform to sell things, and this applies to all of them, but Amazon's kind of the most concrete example. If they are the ones, they started as a platform where only they sold their own items, eventually they let other sellers in to sell their items as well. And then they went back to kind of like making this Amazon Basics brand where they could sell products. But the way that they're able to, you know, make such great moves in random product selling areas, you know, the reasons why they sell you everything from like USB cables to, you know, I guess, you know, that's the market I'm usually in when I'm on Amazon. I don't know what else they sell. Amazon Basics sells everything. Even like really niche stuff like podcast, mic, stands, like stuff like that. Just like basically everywhere I looked, it's like,
yeah,
the first option is an Amazon Basics thing, and then you have the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly kind of the problem that people are, and that Elizabeth Warren is calling out, because if Amazon owns a platform, they can see everything that's going on that platform. You know, maybe someone starts selling, you know, super sweet lawn chairs, and they're like, wow, these lawn chairs are selling like hotcakes.
Yeah.
I'm Amazon. I see that. I'm going to start selling lawn chairs. You know, yeah. I'm going to start pushing these products myself. Why should I let my customers do all that when I can be their competitor? I can get these sales for myself. I'm going to start talking to their suppliers that I know they're using, and I'm going to start selling these things under my own label and start selling them myself. And because I can see all this information, I know there's demand. I might even know where there's, you know, too much demand for the current supply, and I can fill those gaps, and it's essentially like a risk-free bet that they're able to make.
Exactly.
And it is not, so that, while it is like, obviously like a very capitalistic thing to like utilize information you have to make money, right? It is also kind of non-competitive to the customers that are on their platform, because the customers aren't just people who buy things from Amazon. It's also the people who sell things on Amazon.
Yeah.
So by having Amazon also sell things on Amazon, they're competing against their own customers in an unfair game. And so that's kind of her argument, is that once you reach a certain size, you should not be able to compete in your own platform, because it is kind of anti-competitive and unfair, and it squashes some smaller businesses from up and coming.
Yeah.
So I guess I kind of just hit you with a lot. Give me some thoughts.
So one thing I'm thinking about here is obviously the difference between like Amazon and Target, like a much more traditional store versus Amazon. So you look at Target, and if Target is selling Pop Secret movie theater butter popcorn, and then also Market Pantry movie theater butter popcorn, they've purchased all of that and are just distributing it. They produced the Market Pantry by themselves. That's their own label. They can put it as prominently as they want, but they already paid the distributor, Pop Secret, for that product. And now they have to sell it to turn their own profit.
Yeah.
Whereas with Amazon, they just allow the platform so that some other distributor can be seen in a search result. And since Amazon has all the information, knows who's buying what, they can put their thing first. It's most likely cheaper.
Well, it's priced exactly the way they know.
Yes, exactly. They know exactly how much to charge to make it worth it to buy maybe not as high quality product, but a product that'll work. And honestly, Amazon Basics has some really good high quality products.
Oh yeah,
like I use so many. Well, they have
great reviews on the platform that Amazon owns.
Yeah, you know,
shocking. Reviews for their own products usually pretty good.
Yeah, so I mean, you look at this and it's a completely understandable argument as to why we should break up companies like this. I don't agree with it. Which if you talk to me politically, usually it would be something that people I align with politically would agree with, but. And I will start out saying I'm obviously biased in this. I work for Google. This is a company I don't want to see broken up because I want to work with them in the future. But, my personal philosophy is that, in pretty much every industry except for tech, growing bigger only bogs you down and slows down innovation. Whereas in tech, it is fluid and mobile enough that you can create a new team, you can invest internally, and you can innovate a lot quicker with more capital with a larger company. Obviously, these companies are gigantic, and with all of the acquisitions, stuff like that, there's more to be said there. But saying that you need to just break up Amazon is... a little too loose and not non-specific for
me. So the way she defines it, and I did quite a bit of research. Like, I watched her rally video, I watched an interview, I read her Medium blog post that outlaid this. And so the way that she defines kind of her boundaries around this is that if you are a company, like, all companies have to compete in fair ways on their own marketplaces, rule number one. Rule number two, if you're a company that makes over $25 billion, you are designated, and you operate a platform, you are designated as a platform utilities company, and you cannot sell products on that platform. So what would happen if this, if she was elected, she's a Democratic
candidate
right now. What would happen if she was elected in 2020 is that, you know, she would and try to use the legal system to break up these major companies. So you would see Google Search be a separate company from YouTube, be a separate company from Google Drive, you know, all of these things. The side of Amazon and the side of, you know, the side of Google that provides the indexing of the internet and tells you where to go cannot also be the stuff that's trying to appear on that. So these companies would still be huge, and they would still have a lot of resources, and yeah, they would still be able to innovate. But it would, the idea is that it would make it easier, you know, if there was a competitor to YouTube, say, like, no one is really proving that this has happened. Like, let's say you're Vimeo. No one's saying that YouTube is biasing its results so that YouTube is better than Vimeo. But the way, like, the economy works, the way capitalism works, is that they're incentivized to.
Yeah.
And so if they were separate companies, Google and YouTube, Google wouldn't care whether Vimeo or YouTube was greater. So if Vimeo, or was showing up higher in results, so if Vimeo had a better product, Vimeo could, you know, prove itself in the marketplace. Whereas the way that could be potentially happening now, and there's not really any proof that this is happening, which is one of the arguments against this,
yeah,
is that Google could hedge its own results to be in front of other results because it's a private platform. It's not a designated utility company that is, you know, saying it's above a certain size. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of good ideas behind this. And I think that I'm not saying that, like, competition wouldn't increase if this happened.
For sure.
I think it could be a better thing for new companies if, you know, platforms were made more fair through regulation. I'm not saying that that's, like, a terrible idea. I just think that where most people's issue with this comes in is in the how the heck would this be implemented?
Yes.
Because, like, her goal, she's saying, like, we had this great generation of tech companies, and since then, you know, new companies being founded, especially in the consumer sector, have kind of leveled off. We haven't seen a lot of big new things. And so moves like this will help establish a next wave to make sure that we're successful in the future as a country. But people are saying, you know, if you're going to try to unroll Amazon, Google, potentially Apple, Facebook, all these companies, you are going to go through legal hell that will outlast your presidency. Absolutely.
And the engineering work that it would take to decouple. Yeah. So Google has 7 services with over 1 billion users, which means you would have to decouple all of those services from each other because they would be their own company.
They have to start, you know, charging each other for their services.
Yeah.
They have to, like, restructure because, you know, if you're Jeff Bezos, all of a sudden now you can't, you know, have such a hand in the Amazon Alexa.
Yeah.
Because that can't be a product sold on Amazon.com.
Alexa is
going to
be different than, like, you're not going to sell your Echo devices on Amazon. And what's that going to make everything more expensive? You're going to have to pay to use Gmail and Google Drive together, which just hurts consumers. All of this breakup talk, I think, would hurt tech users significantly.
I think it'd be tough to say that it's going to hurt users because, I mean, Google could still, like, so if the part of, one of the other things she was saying is unrolling some of these tech acquisitions that have happened in the past. One of them she called out specifically was Google's acquisition of DoubleClick, which became, like, Google AdSense. So if that was unrolled from Google, you know, YouTube and Google Search could still be free. Facebook could still be free. They could still serve ads, but it would just be ads from a different company. And, you know, maybe their margins wouldn't be as zero as they are right now, but I think that they would still be able to operate. And where, you know, the more consumer-friendly argument is, now you'll be able to see competitors come up more easily.
Yeah. I have a few things with that. First off, a lot of these services are just straight up free.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, a lot of these
are, it's not going to help consumers much if it's just still free.
With Amazon, they're not profitable, you know, A lot of the segments of Amazon are not profitable without the other segments.
Absolutely. And on top of that, if they are all taken apart, it just means that these companies are going to innovate slower. It's going to hurt the advancing of consumer technology. And I just really don't see it actually helping anybody. Plus, the biggest factor in creating a great tech company is doing something that hasn't already been done, right? Like, nobody wants another streaming service because that's just another thing that they would have to pay for. If everything's just on Netflix or Hulu, great.
Mm-hmm.
You can get whichever one you want. Obviously, everybody's going to be trying to make a streaming service here soon, and I'm sure we'll see several of them collapse because not everybody's going to pay for all of the streaming services.
I mean, I think that's a tough argument to make because then you can point towards like companies or like industries where we only have one option, you know, like internet service providers where, you know, right now you might say like, dude, I'm fine if Google owns everything because Google's the best. Well, if Google was Comcast, you might be like, okay, screw this. I wish we would have done something sooner.
Yeah.
You know, and right now Google's great, but 10 years from now, if they're still owning the industry.
Yeah. And I think for sure if they start charging, that's not a good thing. But we have YouTube, which is free. It's a great platform. We don't really need another platform. To kind of bounce between. I don't know. My brain kind of separates technology companies from like physical, tangible goods companies, in where these tech companies, they do something great and they can often give it to consumers for free. Whereas there's pricing competition with physical goods, right? Like you can make a higher quality product and you can price it better. Whereas if you have two free services, it's always going to be whichever one is better.
Yeah, so I mean, with Amazon, this might not apply as much because they are selling physical goods.
Yeah.
But then with, like, the Google thing, one of the things that separates that in my mind is that, like, if there really became a time where everyone hated YouTube as much as they hate podcasts, the way technology works is that it's so, you know, me and you could disrupt YouTube in our college dorm if people hated it and there was a quick technology solution for it. Like, the barrier to entry is so much lower than, like, oh, I have to start an internet service provider. I have to put up towers. I have to do all these regulations. It's like, nope.
The
I
just entire have to
throw something up on a Raspberry Pi and I can get hundreds of thousands of users in a week.
Exactly. Because you are either going to disrupt an already existing non-innovative industry, like shipping, right?
Yeah.
Freight forwarding, right? Something crazy like that you're going to make technologically advanced, or you're just going to create a plain better product than what currently exists. And there's, if you make it well enough, there's going to be plenty of people who want to invest in it.
Yeah. So one of the rabbit holes that this recent news story kind of led me down was Microsoft being sued over Internet Explorer. Andre, do you know the story of Microsoft versus the United States?
I do not, but I can only imagine it is hilarious in retrospect.
So basically, a bunch of... Microsoft was being sued for violating the Sherman Act, like straight up antitrust behavior for bundling a search engine with an operating system, which...
I do remember this case,
it's something that everybody does, right? It's like, how would you download for bundling a web browser with an operating system?
Yeah.
It's like, how would you download a web browser if you didn't have a web browser?
Exactly.
Like, all this stuff.
Nobody's gonna...
Obviously right
there
now...
There aren't CDs that...
Yeah.
Like, there's no CD reader in your laptop anymore.
So I mean, right now that happens all the time. Every OS comes with a web browser, but companies like Netscape were pissed because Microsoft, and Google was pissed because Microsoft was, you know, the thing that comes with Microsoft is Internet Explorer. It uses Alta Vista as its search engine and eventually Bing. And,
oh,
you know,
man.
If you're Google, you're like, oh, crap, like I am not on the by far dominant OS at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how am I ever going to get these users? And so a bunch of these companies, what ended up happening was that the U.S. sued Microsoft for antitrust behavior. In one of the courts, it was settled that Microsoft was going to have to make the OS and the software separate companies. Like, that they was literally ruled in court that Microsoft is going to have to split up. Like, you can't be Internet Explorer and the platform in one company. And obviously Microsoft immediately appealed, went to the Supreme Court, and eventually it was settled outside of court. And what happened was Microsoft made a more like developer-friendly AI for browsers to integrate with. Yeah. And because of that, you know, it was kind of seen as, you know, not a win for the people against Microsoft in that situation. And there was a lot of discussion of like people using this as an example of like why you can't really break up tech companies, how poorly it would go in the legal system, that sort of thing, how there's precedent against it. But then, the further I dug, there were some comments from like ex-Microsoft execs in interviews saying like, you know, like a lot of people saw that as a win for Microsoft, but really like that threat of being broken up into two separate companies and how close everything was to going down like that and what a big deal it was really a giant warning shot to us, and we changed our behavior. Yeah. And without that behavior change, Google would not be the company it is today, this Microsoft exec was saying. He was saying without that, we would have just kept our competitive behavior, we would have kept crushing people at every turn, we'd have leveraged every advantage we have in our operating or in our operating system, bundled everything in, and we would have just kept using Alta Vista, eventually Bing, no one would have had a choice, who really cares about a slightly better search engine at the time. And so because they had this very threatening, very intense court case, they kind of changed their behavior, opened up their platform to allow a lot of other applications to integrate with it, and kind of became more of the style of company that they are today, which wasn't a great thing for a while. You know, it kind of devalued the company a little bit.
Absolutely. I mean, the only reason use their Explorer or Edge is to download Chrome.
Yeah, but the only reason that people can download Chrome now is because of stuff like this court case. So. Yeah. It might not be that this Elizabeth Warren policy push, you know, leads to whatever Democratic nominee runs, if they got elected. It might not be that that leads to something actually breaking up all of the FANG companies, because that would be insane. But what might happen is this might, you know, put some of these companies on watch. And
for sure.
Maybe Facebook wouldn't buy Instagram next time.
Yeah.
And a lot of these moves that, you know, at the time, it's like, okay, yeah, I mean, they're kind of in different areas, but now it's like, what social media can you use besides Snapchat that isn't Facebook? You know, like Twitter, which is kind of a different service. I don't know. Yeah. There's a whole thing about just how massive these companies have gotten and how things could have gone differently, but
this
Elizabeth Warren, if she could do it, she'd go back, undo the Whole Foods acquisition, undo the Zappos acquisition, undo the Waze acquisition, undo the Instagram acquisition, undo the WhatsApp acquisition. All of these were specifically named of saying, like, it violates this idea she has of you can't be an umpire and a player, which I think is a good thought. And then another argument that people have against it is, like, all of these acquisitions were approved, and going back and undoing them is, like, overreaching the executive branch, overreaching the legislative branch, because, like, the judicial branch ruled that these things are constitutional.
Obviously, it takes a lot of institutional change to even start to try to do that. Mm-hmm. But what you're talking about there really brings up a deeper point that I think I agree with, which is these companies don't need to be broken up, but there needs to be well-thought-out technical legislation on these concepts that tech companies really only know about, because right now we have a bunch of politicians that know law and business, right? Mm-hmm. They don't know tech. We don't have engineers running for president saying, oh, we need to have more companies make their platforms more accessible for other companies.
Yeah, that's another thing. If the government determined how to break up Facebook or Amazon right now, I'd be horrified at what they came up with. Because they would have, you have to really understand how everything works, even at like a software level, if you're going to know how and what, like, the way these things operate in order to separate
them. Like, honestly, the federal government should have some sort of technological or software or computing department by now, and I'm kind of shocked we don't. But
I'm sure they have some sort of advisor, and I'm sure it's some guy who was like the CEO of, like, you know, Comcast for a few years.
Yeah, we definitely need a department filled with federal workers who are actual engineers who can understand the nuance of all of this, because I absolutely agree that maybe Windows should be more accepting to Firefox and Chrome running on its operating system, but I don't think that means that you need to entirely break up Microsoft, which gets me back to my original point, which is that these big companies can innovate super fast and super well. So if you tell Microsoft, hey, it is now the law that you have to have your API specifically open enough for these for other browsers to be accessed on your operating system, that's a much more technical and specific requirement, which then forces Microsoft to say, oh man, we better get our act together and actually make a good operating system or web browser so people actually want to use our web browser on our operating system, mm-hmm. rather than just saying, we want to break you up. Because I think at this point, these companies know they're not going to get broken up, at least in the next 10 years.
Well, I mean, we've seen them make some moves to kind of, like, fortify themselves against getting broken up, like Facebook.
Like Facebook integrating the back end of their messaging.
Yeah, just this week, Chrome added DuckDuckGo as an option
for searching
a lot of
markets,
and a lot of people are like, they could be doing that to say, like, hey, look, like, we provide all different types of options in our in our browser.
But that's also something where it's like, that could be a regulation that you make. You make a lot of specific regulations about web browsers and operating systems and smartphones and security chips and all of these different things. You make specific regulations on every single thing. And I think that is what makes the tech scene more competitive, is when every single thing has its own regulations, not just saying big companies can't exist.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough because you know, then you'll hit edge cases.
Exactly.
But it's a balance between that and being too broad.
Yeah,
but
there's always loopholes in laws.
Yeah,
it's not going to change with tech.
I think one of the things that, like, I didn't even have time to really mention here at the end, I just want to get in quick, is that Spotify is actually suing Apple right now. They filed, like, a case with the EU, an antitrust case, saying, like, their pricing on the App Store is, like, anti-competitive, that Spotify can't, like, sell and, like, promote their subscription in their app without Apple taking a 30% cut. So
interesting.
There's a lot of pressure on these companies right now, and I don't think we're going to see, like, a complete 180 on the way these things work. I don't think we're going to see the companies split up, but, I mean, hopefully we'll see more pressure on these companies, and we'll see pressure make diamonds. Yeah. So
regulation and pressure. I don't think we need to break up the companies, but...
Yeah. Cool. Awesome. All right. Well, that's all I got for this week.
All right. You can contact us on Twitter. Shoot us a DM. Tweet at us at HackersPod. Send us an email at hackerslackerpod@gmail.com. Thank you for listening, and we will be back in 2 weeks.
Bye. Thank you.